And what we're talking about, I mean, depending on the length of the tunnel, we want to put, you know, thousands of these worker bees, for want of a better word, or, you know, like termites create huge structures in the ground from small little fragments of soil that they take and create their burrows. In the same way, we want to send our bots in a controlled manner, but in a swarm controlled manner, to go and do their work at a given location. They're communicating with themselves, that not just in their own pipe, but also pipe to pipe, because the pipes are close enough that we can create that mesh network between them, so they are all aware of what the others are doing. If there is a problem with one of them, that's no problem, because you've got thousands of them all operating it, so that one can be removed from the system and replaced. Meanwhile, activity is going on elsewhere, so you never have that sort of single point of failure that you might do in a let's say in a tunnel boring machine, where something, a key element might go down, then everything stops. Our swarm technology allows us to have that multiple layers of redundancy, so that we'd never have that issue.
Stay tuned to hear about this and other emerging technologies. I'm Steve Hadley, and this is the Breaking Ground podcast.
Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement, and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple story basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
I'm joined by Patrick Lane-Knott, Director of Engineering at Hypertunnel Limited. Hypertunnel promised to revolutionise tunnel construction in the UK, and it's an absolute pleasure to be joined by Patrick and hear about all of his ideas. I want to start by actually saying what Hypertunnel isn't, because I think when I first heard about it, I kind of thought it was a bit like what Elon Musk is doing with his boring project, this vacuum tube technology. But that's not the case, Patrick, is it? It's something quite different to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Steve, for having me, first of all. It is, yeah, absolutely fundamentally different. I think what we are doing at Hypertunnel is approaching tunnelling in a very different way to the current methods, and even more in a different capacity to the way that Elon and his team are going about it. Because, you know, traditionally you would have tunnel boring machines, large, you know, thousands and thousands of tons of hardware boring through the ground. And in essence, that's pretty much how tunnelling has been for almost 100 years. I mean, I think if you went back in time to when they were first being used, there's still the main elements of a tunnel boring machine are the same as they are now, albeit, yes, obviously they have developed, but it's very much been small iterations rather than anything revolutionary.
But in the sense that hyper literally means sort of extreme, and so I suppose you are producing extreme technology in what you're doing, and yeah, as you say, there's, in terms of existing technologies for tunnel construction, the tunnel boring machine is probably the most widely used in the UK. I think it's fair to say there are other techniques, such as the cut and cover technique, which would be for fairly shallow tunnel construction, and would it be reasonable to suggest that you're not trying to compete with that particular field? It's more the deeper technology that the tunnel boring machine would offer.
Yeah, I mean, I think in essence, Steve, what Hypertunnel is trying to provide to the market is an alternative. And to your point about hyper, it is, we are looking to do things faster, safer and cheaper than the current methods. You know, if you do compare to tunnel boring machines, or to where you have people and on board throughout the whole process, that's inherently a dangerous situation. And, you know, that there's risk involved in having people literally at the cutting face. If you talk about drill and blast, again, inherent dangers in that sort of solution. And even in cut and cover, there is, you know, you still have to have people within the environment. Whereas, as you suggest at Hyperton, we are doing things very differently, and we are actually approaching the problem pretty much from a blue sky perspective. The team that we put together to bring the Hypertunnel method to life is actually from a whole range of different backgrounds. From myself, I'm actually a motorsport engineer. I spent 20 years working for Formula One and Le Mans teams around the world. And the team that we put together is diverse. We have people from academia, but we also have people from the aviation industry, from the renewable energies, from the defense industries, but no one specifically from tunneling within the core engineering team. And that's so that we can cross-pollinate and bring some really fresh and new ideas into the challenge. And yes, by the nature of our process or our solution to the tunneling world, we are utilizing existing techniques and technologies as much as possible, but we're also trying to fuse those with the new technologies of the age, you know, the digital world, the digital twins, fusing of data sources, and all of sort of the benefits that we can actually get from artificial intelligence, and most importantly, bringing robotics into it, but actually not your traditional sort of assembly line robot where it's a large scale, expensive machine, but more along the much more small scale, I guess a little bit like drones, but in the sense that we are using small robots to be able to dig and create our tunnels. And so that's really, I guess, the key element.
Well, we're going to break all that down into digestible elements. Interesting you mentioned Formula One there. I will be, after the call is done, picking your brains to find out exactly what went on there between Max and Lewis at the weekend. Pretty gutting for most of us British F1 fans. So I suppose, as somebody that's fairly new to tunneling myself, one of the biggest perceived dangers is around compressed air when you're using tunnel boring machines. So this is when you're trying to create these holes deep in the ground, you've got water pressures, earth pressures, really the tunnel boring machine would just squeeze together like a can without the use of compressed air. So that's traditionally why they had to use it to balance out the pressures. But of course, putting humans in that environment is extremely risky. Does your technology find a way of removing compressed air altogether from the process?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that I guess the key element to our process is that we don't actually have any humans in the environment during the construction or excavation phases. We break our process down into four key elements, which is a preparation phase, a construction phase, an excavation phase, and then a completion phase. The phases are self-explanatory, but in essence, we do a lot of preparation work in the first place, in the first phase, to do data gathering of not just the ground that we would be tunneling through, but also the surrounding ground, because our technique actually utilizes that as some of the support. And then in the actual construction phase, as I say, we don't put any humans into the firing line. It's very much a hands-off remote process controlled from a control room outside of the tunneling environment. And even when we get to the excavation phase, that again is all done remotely, semi-autonomously. And the idea is that we don't want to have anyone in there until we have a structure that is competent and sound and safe to be able to be put people into. So
that's great. And I know you've already done some trials, which maybe later on in the recording we'll discuss. But let's start with the digital twin that you mentioned, and clearly borrowing the technology that you've found in F1. Why is that so important?
I think the digital twin is absolutely key as a fulcrum for the whole process. I guess rewinding a little bit to my background, I mean, I was using digital twin, albeit under a different name. That's certainly the name that everyone's calling it these days. But 20 years ago, I was doing simulations with Formula One cars in the same way that digital twins are being talked about now, where you are bringing data from lots and lots of different areas and what might have effects on the object that you are simulating. And you can then effectively work out and develop to improve either your product or your process by utilizing that digital twin. And we absolutely want to do that. As I say, my motorsport background very much brings in data into the equation and using data for all aspects of the process, from the preparation, gathering data from lots and lots of different sources. And we want to use that data throughout. So it's not just a case of generating data for data's sake. Data is useful for the here and now, but it's also good for analysis of what's gone before so you can improve what happens in the future. So improving processes and the like. And that's absolutely what we want to do. So as part of our preparation phase, we would gather data from lots of different sources, and that's geological surveys and also other environmental aspects of the ground and the environment that we will actually be operating in, and bring all that together with, again, standard sort of geophysics techniques as well. So ground penetrating radar and seismic and other such technologies that, again, are already out there, but we're using them in a fundamentally different way. So instead of trying to gather information from the surface, we actually bore a hole along the whole path of the tunnel and then put our tools within that so that we can then actually get literally right inside the ground that we're interested in, so we can get as accurate and as a detailed picture as possible of the ground that we'd be working with, which inherently de-risks the whole overall project because you're much more aware of what's coming up. You don't have to prepare for the unexpected. Everything is expected and you absolutely know what you're going to encounter. And that allows you to prepare in advance so that you are absolutely able to drive forward and create your tunnel as fast and as efficiently as you can, but obviously 100% safe.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned the potentially existing technology. There's been BIM talked about in the construction industry for quite a number of years now. And we've used software like Revit to help create three-dimensional models and put, say, for instance, with my business Pilin, we might model the services that are on a site and have the piles going down. It sounds like a similar principle to that idea. It's just maybe been rebadged, or what would you say to that, Patrick?
I think that there's elements of that. I think the key difference with the digital twin, in my mind anyway, is the fact that, yes, that certainly helps from the, as you say, the BIM elements, and that's certainly a massive step forward than previous techniques. And I think it is slowly gaining acceptance within the industry, and people are understanding the benefits of it, especially in an environment where you've got lots and lots of different players who may be using different platforms. To have some sort of format that everyone can get involved with and use is certainly very beneficial. But I think the digital twin itself, as you take it through the process, so if we talked about the preparation phase, if you then go into the construction phase, you can take the data that you've got in that preparation phase, and that can completely allow you to plan your construction phase right down to the sort of minutiae. And then that will then allow you to be able to do your construction as efficiently as possible. Meanwhile, you're also gathering data during that construction phase that can be useful later on in the process. So in an ideal world, we want to get to a point where we can construct our tunnel and gather enough data so that we can actually have a digital sign-off from an assurance perspective. In a tunneling world, that's obviously absolutely key to be able to say that you've got a safe and sound structure that will be around and safe for many decades or centuries to come. And so, you know, our intention is to get to that point. It's going to be a journey to get to that. And obviously there's a lot of challenges ahead of us to be able to get to that point. But it really goes down to gathering the data and the right data, analysing the data so that you can make some informed decisions, but also to have that empirical proof to be able to demonstrate that your structure is sound.
Sure. Now, I know that the NATM technique, which you've probably done a bit of research into, this is the new Austrian tunnelling method, which is, it's not that new, actually. It's been around since the 60s. It was created to speed up construction, particularly in rock soils, which admittedly we don't have too much in the UK, but is widely used around the world. They spray concrete as they go, but they're also taking values for the strength of the rock as they advance. So the methodology, the size of the tunnels and the lining is adjusted to suit. And it sounds like you're creating real-time solutions through your modelling as well, which I'm sure will create really efficient solutions. And one part of the construction solution is around horizontal directional drilling, which again, I'm afraid I'm not very familiar with. It's technology you've borrowed it from another industry. Which industry have you gathered information?
So the horizontal directional drilling as a I guess as a technology is actually very mature. It was developed in the US over 50 years ago. I think it recently had its 50th birthday or unofficial birthday. And it's actually effectively a no dig technology. So it allows you to drill through the ground from point A to point B. And then once the drill has gone through one way, you can then attach a pipe or some form of conduit, and then you can drag that back through the hole that you just dug. So effectively you're creating an A to B for that service. In the US, it's been used to great effect for going under water bodies or under the large freeways and motorways they have in the US. So it allows them to be able to do all of that connection of services from one side to the other without actually having to stop the flow of traffic or rail or whatever it is that they're trying to get out, get through or under. And as I say, in the last decade or so, the technology has been really finessed to a point where the accuracy is you know, amazing, really. They're now at the point where they're using missile-guided gyro technology to be able to steer the head. And that allows them to be really, really accurate so that they can literally hit targets within centimetres on the over relatively large distances. Now, how we're using that technology is really to provide ourselves with access to the geology down the whole of the tunnel path. As part of our sort of preparation phase, we drill a whole number of horizontal directional drilling bores approximately a metre apart around the edge of where the tunnel will end up being, the tunnel wall. What that does is that allow us access to the geology throughout the whole length of the tunnel. So literally you have these conduits that run the whole length of the tunnel and all around the whole of the what will become the external surface or the shell of the tunnel. And what that allows us to do is access to any point at any point of the tunnel so that we can then start to use some of our robotic swarm technology to be able to go on and initially do some analysis and some surveying through those pipes. And they are, as I say, HDPE plastic, high density polyethylene pipes. And they are approximately 280 mil in diameter. And that allows us a conduit to be able to put our bots, the downpipe bots that will go down in along the length and perform a whole bunch of different tasks from surveying to construction to monitoring and everything in between. So
okay, I was going to ask you say that they're 200 mil. I mean, people might think, well, why don't you just create the whole tunnel using this sort of technology? But presumably it's because making a 200 mil hole is one thing, making a 5 meter diameter hole is completely different.
No, absolutely, and that's really the key thing. I mean, I think the realistic limits of horizontal directional drilling are, I mean, the idea is you go with a small bore one way and then you can ream back and make it larger on each pass. And obviously staying within the limits of something sensible with regards to the rig, because the rig has to do drilling and pulling. So it ends up becoming quite large when you get to some of the larger bores. But you kind of get up to maybe 1.5 meters, but obviously that's not really big enough for a tunnel per se. It might be okay for certain tunnel applications, maybe sewers and that sort of stuff. And it is used in that application. But when you start to get to a point where you want to maybe put down vehicles or trains or hyperloops, then you need to start thinking about quite a larger size. And so that's really what we're doing, is going around the periphery of the tunnel itself to be able to access, understand what the geology is, do some specific work about creating, consolidating ground or building within the ground, so 3D printing. And again, our bots move around like the head of a 3D printer, so we can put down and place construction material, and that may take a form of there's various different options we have there, again, depending on what the geological conditions are. But we can go down to any point and start creating the tunnel structure within the ground, using the ground as a support medium. So in the same way that you would with a 3D printer, you might have some additional construction parts that allow you to build it within free space. We actually use the ground to hold it in place. And once we're done, we can then, and we're happy we've got a full and complete structure that's sound, we can then remove the soil or the ground inside the envelope of the, or the profile of the tunnel.
So are you you're not trying to create a weak zone to pull the material out from? These horizontal directional drills, that they are literally like boreholes to help you understand the ground, and then you've got a more conventional drilling method to go in behind it.
So the boreholes themselves are conduits for our bots to go down, and they use these plastic pipes to be able to access any point. And then what we do from the pipes is we drill through the pipes, because they're only HDPE, and we have some specific technology that allows us to drill through and keep the outside out and the inside in, so that we don't get whatever's going on outside coming into our pipe. And we can then deploy chemistry or cement or any sort of construction material through the skin of the pipe and into the surrounding ground. And that might be a consolidation, or it might actually be a complete replacing of the ground with a structure. So depending on, again, on the geological conditions.
Okay, so I'm currently imagining these little robots going down these pipes. So was it Fraggle Rock when they had those little people working underground? Anyway, sorry, just flying back to my childhood. Tell us more about these bots and how they work.
Yeah, so I guess the idea is they're semi-autonomous, so they're controlled in a swarm style, and they're all given specific jobs to do, and they'll go to a given location and do that job. The idea is that they are very simple. Then, as I say, they're not complex sort of assembly line robots. They are, we're looking for a pretty low price point for the bots, because that needs to happen to be to allow us to do the swarming. And what we're talking about, depending on the length of the tunnel, we want to put thousands of these worker bees, for want of a better word, or like termites create huge structures in the ground from small little fragments of soil that they take and create their burrows. In the same way, we want to send our bots in a controlled manner, but in a swarm controlled manner, to go and do their work at a given location. And each of these bots, again, they're based on a sort of standard chassis or standard platform, and they can go to a given location. They're communicating with themselves, not just in their own pipe, but also pipe to pipe, because the pipes are close enough that we can create that mesh network between them. So they are all aware of what the others are doing. They're controlled in a similar way that you'll have seen these large drone displays, where they have thousands of bots of drones flying around, flashing lights and that sort of stuff to create pictures in the sky. That control mechanism or the control system that's looking after that is having to deal with lots and lots of different environmental conditions. Our bots are only traveling up or down in a single pipe. The key thing is that they can pass. So the actual profile of the bot is actually half the pipe size. So they can actually pass each other in the pipe. And that provides us with a significant efficiency from a logistics perspective of making sure that we're creating in a really efficient manner. But I guess it harks back to the old days when they used to have when the cost of a human life wasn't quite as it was now, and they had all the construction workers or navvies working. And the way that they used to be able to do some of the really fast construction techniques was to have lots of them working at lots of different faces. So they would drop shafts all the way down the length of the tunnel, drop the team of navvies down, and then they would work in lots of different directions towards each other, so they were actually working on multiple faces. A TBM these days works on a single face, but it's a massive machine, cruises through the ground at a relatively slow pace. So, back in the day of the navvies, they realized that you could create massive efficiencies by just having lots and lots of people doing small tasks over and over again. Our swarm technology is effectively the same as that, but without the dangers inherent in having lots of people doing it. We have bots that don't care what pressure or how long they've been working. They're quite happy to carry on doing what they need to do. And If there is a problem with one of them, that's no problem because you've got thousands of them all operating it. So that one can be removed from the system and replaced. Meanwhile, activity is going on elsewhere. So you never have that sort of single point of failure that you might do in a tunnel boring machine where something, a key element might go down, then everything stops. The whole supply chain stops all the way through, and that ripples back to, you know, what could be a relatively simple fix or a simple problem, but that delay is inherently stops the whole job. Whereas our swarm technology allows us to have that multiple layers of redundancy so that we'd never have that issue.
So how big would a bot be?
A bot would be maybe 2 or 3 meters long. Again, half the profile of a pipe. The internal diameter of the pipe, so the OD of our pipes is about 280 millimeters. The inside, the working sort of profile is about 200 mil. So if you imagine a half bot, which is a half pipe size with a 200 mil diameter, that's the sort of the size and profile and shape of form of our bots.
So they're working within the pipe rather than working within a shield in the way that a tunnel boring machine would work. So, but you do have this other product, the Hyper Shield, which is used in conjunction. Does that come later?
Yes. So what that comes in later, that's the excavation phase. So again, we're in the situation where we're creating a new tunnel. We would, as I say, once we've got our HDP pipe in place through the horizontal directional drilling, we send our bots down. They would do a whole bunch of activity, creating a structure in the ground in a 3D printing method. And then once we're happy that we've done all the work that we can, and again, going back to the data analysis and the data gathering, at each point when the bot goes to a specific location to do a job, all of that data would be logged. So it would be logged, not just where the position is, what chemistry has been deployed into the ground, what pressure, what volume that we of chemistry we put in. All of that is valuable information that we can use later on for the proof or the data to show that we've constructed the tunnel in the way that we planned in the first preparation phase. And what that allows us to do is to be able to have a real good confidence that we've created a structure, which we can then back up with our survey tools. I talked a little bit earlier on about the survey tools that we have. And again, they can fit down the same diameter pipes. And because they're right in the ground that we're interested in, they can take really good high definition imagery of the structure that we've created. And that we want to get to a point where you will have effectively an immersive experience where you can don a pair of a VR goggles and take a virtual walk down the tunnel and be able to see not just some of the geological features, whether that's fissures and voids and water table levels and all this sort of stuff. But then as the construction phase continues, you're able to see that be created in real time, because we're forever surveying, and in a single location we'll have created a part of the structure. We can go back and check that that's happened as it was by doing a local survey. All of that gives us really good confidence that the structure's in place. Once all of that's sort of signed off and we're happy, we can then move into the excavation phase, which is where the Hyper Shield comes in. Now, the fact that we're calling it a shield, I guess, is a sort of nod to historical ways of tunneling, but it's actually more aligned with a dragline bucket. I don't know whether you're aware of the sort of dragline buckets that are used in open cast mining, that effectively large scoops that can pick up huge volumes of ground of whatever the material you're quarrying and move it around. So we're literally talking hundreds of tons for each scoop, and it's controlled or created or maneuvered using cables. And, you know, literally hundreds of tons every sort of 30-second cycle. Our Hyper Shield is effectively very similar to that, where we have the structure that we've created in the ground. Now, what we're able to do is in the sort of middle of what will become the tunnel, we also have some survey bores, and those were part of what I talked about earlier on about taking a core sample down the whole length of the tunnel, and that allows us to be able to understand really well what's happening in the ground. But we can then utilize that same hole and ream it out to approximately sort of 1.2, 1.5 meters that we were talking about before. That then creates space for the ground within the shell that we've created to start to collapse within the tunnel, which is exactly what we want. We want to remove that loose spoil, and that's where the shield comes in. The shield comes in and effectively scoops up all of that spoil and removes it very, very quickly. And again, I think I talked about really what we're trying to do is to bring lots and lots of techniques and technology from other areas and arenas. And again, in the sort of ore mining world, they're capable of moving spoil in massive volumes, you know, literally tens of thousands of tons an hour with conveyor belts and that sort of stuff. And, you know, really what we want to be able to do is to be able to remove the spoil as quick as we physically can. And again, that will depend on the site and where we're at and the limitations. But what we've done is we've effectively changed the limitations or the constraints of tunneling, whereas it's currently the limitation is how quickly you can actually dig through the ground physically, because you can't, the tunnel boring machines now are such a size that they can't physically go any quicker than they can without effectively destroying them and making a much bigger hole than they want to make. We're actually changing the constraints to actually how quickly can you get the spoil out of the ground, which is another much better problem to have, because there's a ways you can manage that. And I guess that's, you know, it goes back to our thoughts about the whole hyper element of the technology, the fact that we want to do it faster, cheaper and safer than current methods.
Sure. Well, a couple of questions on that. You mentioned material falling in. It's long been established, actually, there's a lot of surface ground movement and effect on structures when tunneling happens. So presumably you're using a team of geotechnical engineers to look at, well, if we've got this much movement at the tunnel location, this is the effect at surface level and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the process, and again, during that sort of initial preparation phase where we're data gathering, we have the capability to place sensors throughout the ground. So that all of the typical sensors you might want to do, whether it's accelerometers or moisture or temperature, whatever you might be interested. And these can be placed in specific locations, again, from our pipes, so we can access the geology at any point. And we can create a whole network, which all of that data can then be fed back into the digital twin that we were talking about before. And that gives you not only a sort of plan view, but you can then have a live view of what's going on in the tunnel. And you can understand how things are moving, whereabouts, where operations are, all of that sort of element. As far as sort of heave within the ground and that sort of area, we're very conscious of that. And that's, you know, part of the sort of clear work that we're doing at the moment is to demonstrate the processes that we want to use will be able to control that, so that you don't have those large amounts of heave or issues that you might get with other techniques.
Okay, so you've created your hole. You still need to create the lining for the tunnel. Is that still done with precast panels or reinforced concrete, steel? What sort of technique would you use for that?
So I guess that's a good question. I guess depending on which, we have a couple of techniques that we can create our structure within the ground. Certainly the one where we might just strengthen or permeate the ground locally, where we use what we call a hyper bit technology, which effectively is a drill bit that allows us to place some of the construction materials where we want them. That may be where we have it becomes a primary lining and you need to follow up with a secondary lining. We think that we can get to a point where actually that could become the primary lining in certain applications. But we're also developing an additional technique where we're able to, rather than just deploy through the pipe, we can actually go from the pipe and create blocks within the ground that will actually end up becoming our final solution and the final tunnel lining. So we are... and again, a lot of this is all driven by the geology that you're talking about you know, whether it's clay or sands or rock. There's different techniques, but the overall sort of methodology is similar in that you're creating access by putting pipes into the ground that allow you to go and do whatever the key elements of that specific construction technique for that geology on a completely customized basis. So because you can go to any point and do any activity or any task, it provides the ultimate flexibility.
Patrick, you mentioned that it's a faster technique, which has got to be good economically and presumably environmentally. See, the world's changed. We're a lot more conscious of reducing carbon. That might call into question the viability of some projects. How do you see the political environment now to taking on let's say Crossrail 2 or other large infrastructure projects that involve tunneling?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Steve. I think absolutely, we are 100% behind all of those sort of initiatives. I think part of our raison d'etre is actually the initial brainchild of Steve Jordan and Jeremy Hammond, the sort of co-founders, and Steve, who came up with the technique itself, was based on tidal range tunnels. This is a scheme where they are using the tidal range we have specifically in the UK, but it's applicable anywhere there is a specific tidal range. So the distance between high and low tides, to be able to harness the power of the tides. So that's very much sort of where one of the reasons why Hypertunnel came into his existence was because Steve was looking for different ways to be able to make it economically viable, because it does involve, tens or hundreds of tunnels being created. But there was no economies of scale. And so part of the reason why Hypertunnel came into being was because Steve went to try and find ways of creating economies of scale within tunneling projects. And in that came up with the Hypertunnel method, which brought in lots and lots of techniques and technology from lots of different areas to create that, the overall method.
Sorry to interrupt. Was that the Cardiff Bay project that he was looking to get
So not specific. I mean, in Cardiff Bay, they are doing some tidal, they do some tidal work and some tidal testing for that very reason, because in and around the Severn estuary, I think it's got the second highest tidal range in the world, second only to the Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia. So it's there's a real opportunity there, and that's why all the activity is around Cardiff Bay. But again, that's to do with lagoons and creating lagoons, which you hold the water in and then you let it out in a controlled manner, which in essence you can harness it that way, but that has had a lot of knock-on effects about holding so much water back when you start to scale up, not just in an individual lagoon but lots of lagoons. And by holding water back, you can actually affect the tides and the height of tides significantly. And some modeling suggests that if you were to spin out the lagoon style tidal energy recovery, you could actually affect the high and low tide in the Netherlands up to a meter or so, which obviously wouldn't make the people living in Amsterdam particularly happy. So but again, that's I guess another subject. But going back to your initial question about carbon, I think one of our drivers is, yes, currently we're proposing to utilize existing construction materials, which obviously do have a significant carbon content. Now, initially, we're looking to be much more efficient with the use of them, so only using enough and not just in a typical engineering style having lots and lots of belt and braces. We are looking to be much more surgical. I mean, we actually sort of nickname our technique a bit like keyhole surgery, where we're going in and only moving and adapting what we need to locally. Now, that's I guess one side of it. So we're being much more efficient. We're also utilizing a lot of the existing ground to be able to create our structures. So you're not having to bring aggregate or building construction materials across in and around to the work site itself, because we're inherently using that. So there's benefits there. There's also benefits in our excavation technique, because we take the spoil out as it is. It can be utilized locally on the other civil works or elsewhere close by. It doesn't need to have any post-processing. So again, that's much more efficient. We're looking to be able to run and charge our bots on much greener technology than currently. But I guess the overarching element is that by making a much more efficient, safer and cheaper process, what it does is it provides our potential customers of the process an option. They can either do it with the current technique and take benefit of the fact that it's cheaper and quicker, or they could suggest, okay, well, we actually want to construct this with carbon neutral construction materials. Now, those carbon neutral materials have been around for quite a while. Most of the major manufacturers of such materials have created solutions that are, carbon neutral or close to, but they're expensive at the moment. And so, as we all know, all construction projects always come down to cost in the end, because that's always the driver, is cost, to whether it's time, but time equates to cost and everything else. And so what unfortunately happens is it always comes down to that cost. And so you can't actually do that carbon neutral or near carbon neutral solution or option because it ends up driving the price up significantly. What we'd like to be able to do is offer the process and give the end user the option to be able to say, okay, well, it'll cost the same as it would have done normally in a normal construction method, but actually we've done it in a carbon neutral manner. Or you can do it in use the same construction, have the same carbon overhead, but it's done in a much quicker way. And again, that has environmental benefits in itself just by doing it quicker, because that means that the disruption or the inconvenience to the local area is significantly less, the dust, all the other things that come inherently with it. So, you know, what we're doing is providing significant options and then leaving those decisions down to the people who are driving it, like the governments. And you know, we really very much, you know, we're already engaged in significant discussions with some large scale projects, both in Europe and in the US. And obviously, it's very much the sort of the word and the discussion of the moment is about how to drive that down. And again, a lot of that comes to how you're measuring it too. It's quite tricky to really equate what the benefits of creating, let's say, a tunnel. You know, if you create a tunnel and you have to put a whole bunch of carbon in to create that tunnel, but actually what it means is that tens of thousands of cars every single day don't have to do a detour around whatever you're trying to tunnel through, then, you know, overall the whole project is way better for the environment than not having it. But again, that's not always how the sums go, and it's all about the asset itself rather than the benefits that it might actually provide long term.
Who are your partners then? You mentioned you've got a few clients lined up, but I know there's other people working directly with Hypertunnel. I recognise a few of the names.
Yeah, no, so I think, well, we're obviously working closely with a number of key players in the industry. Certainly on the materials side, we're working closely with Master Builders Construction Chemical, which was until recently part of the BASF Underground Construction Group. So we're certainly doing a fair amount of development work with them, but we are talking to players throughout the industry, because if things go as we plan and hope, there'll be scope for more than individual players to be involved in it. It's very much by bringing the process, you know, to the industry itself, we're looking to talk to anyone who's interested in such techniques and you know, providing the opportunity to be able to do things in a slightly different, more efficient and safer way. We're currently working on a project directly for Network Rail. Network Rail, it was a European-wide request to the industry for low disruption tunnels and construction methods. Now, you know, Network Rail currently, whilst they're probably not planning lots and lots of new tunnels in the near future, they do have 650 or so Victorian tunnels that are over 150 years old. That's the average age, I think, is about 150 years old. So, you know, whilst they're amazing structures, they do need a bit of TLC. They really do need some significant work and repair work to be able to keep them standing and be able to be used for the coming decades. And all of that is difficult and expensive just because of the nature of how the sort of the rail network is set up. When Network Rail have to close a tunnel, that costs them a lot of money to the train operating companies, the commuters and everyone else in between. So they're interested in being able to maintain their tunnels in a significantly more efficient and less disruptive way. And part of our techniques, you know, we talked a lot individually about all the different elements of our technique, but actually, if you were to take a single HDP pipe rather than creating a new tunnel, you could do a single or maybe a couple of them alongside the outside of an existing tunnel. We could do all the same processes that they would normally do from the inside of the tunnel whilst the trains, in Network Rail's case, are still running. And so obviously that is significantly preferable than having to close the line at great disruption. So that's why Network Rail are working with us, and part of our work with them is demonstrating our capabilities and making sure, as we were talking about before, about controlling the pressures in the ground and all that sort of stuff. And that's part of the work we're doing with them to showcase what we can do with our techniques.
Oh, terrific. Well, there's a few London Underground lines that I could recommend you get started on as well. The Northern Line isn't the best, so maybe start there. But you've already got some projects underway in terms of case studies. Is it Basingstoke you're based in?
That's right. Yeah. So we're based in Basingstoke. So we have our sort of offices are there, but we also have an outdoor testing facility we call the Hull. Which actually stands for something. It's the Hypertunnel Outdoor Learning Environment. And yes, absolutely, we're able to do and demonstrate a lot of our techniques. And that's really where we've been working for, pandemic permitting, over the last 18 months. We've been working there to develop our techniques and our technologies so that we can work with people like Network Rail to help them out. That's really the key.
Brilliant. I know there'll be young engineers, some experienced engineers as well, listening to this, thinking, I wouldn't mind getting involved with Hypertunnel. Do you foresee a lot of job opportunities for geotechnical engineers, geologists coming up?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's absolutely, where we're headed. I think our predictions and the size of the company, the predictions are significant. We're looking to grow in the next 6 to 18 months significantly, to be able to not just bring a lot of our techniques and technology to the market, but also, as you say, to work on some of the specific projects. By their nature, a lot of the civil projects are they're not done in months. They're planned over years, and so we want to be able to be involved with as many of those as possible. So we're absolutely looking to develop our skill base within the team and to grow, to be able to work with as many different areas as possible, because there are so many opportunities. And if you think of the, not just the tunneling projects that are ongoing at the moment, which obviously in the UK there's a significant amount, but I think globally there's so many different opportunities, and we want to get to a point where, with Hypertunnel method on the table as an option, some of the projects that have been shelved many years ago because of they were thrown out because it was too costly, we would like to think that they would be able to be pulled back off the shelf and dusted off and actually become potential projects. And again, we think with some of the efficiencies of our swarm technology, we want to be able to create a technology that can be reused and recycled on us significantly, so we're able to maximize the benefit and create I guess jobs, but also create solutions and create tunnels and we talked a lot about tunnels specifically, but I think a lot of our techniques are able to be utilized in lots of other underground construction, whether it's inspection of buried assets, or whether it's underground car parks, or storage facilities, data centers. All of these, we're having these conversations with lots of different applications of our method, from, as I say, from creating structures within the ground, but even just ground strengthening, consolidation, things like alternative methods of strengthening dams, cofferdams, and that sort of stuff. So that there's lots of opportunities for different elements of the techniques, and we'll need to have teams that will be able to work in all these different areas. So yeah, absolutely.
Terrific.
We're looking to grow.
Well, you've really opened my mind today to the possibilities of different techniques. We do have a LinkedIn group, which hopefully you don't mind if I invite you into that, because as much as I've tried to ask as many of the key questions as possible today, I'm sure our listeners will have lots more. So if I tag you in, hopefully January, February, listeners will send in some questions to you, and we can maybe put a bit more information on the page as well so they can learn more.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Steve. I would absolutely welcome that. I mean, we love questions from industry. As you say, we do have the benefit of our technical board on our technical board, so that we have a balance between our engineering core team, which aren't specifically tunneling engineers. We do have the tunneling expertise of the sort of the great and the good from the tunneling world, and that allows us a really good sounding board for some of our ideas to make sure that they will fly. But no, we love the interaction with the industry, and we love any sort of questions that come away. So very, very happy to be involved in the LinkedIn group. I mean, I'm on LinkedIn too. Again, if people have listened to the podcast and want to link in, very happy to do that. And very happy to talk and describe the process at length and answer any questions to anyone who might be interested. Because as I say, it's all about getting the information to the people so that they can, you know, they can work with it. So
that's fantastic. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Thanks for your time. Thanks for having me.
Fascinating stuff. If you're involved in emerging technologies that offer a sustainable solution, then do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.